Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Standard & Poor's is going to get $1.5 billion poorer because it turns out we are not really done with the financial crisis quite yet. Also, the long, slow death of Radio Shack and our new series on water. It's called The High Price of Cheap. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's great to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 3rd of February today, and our top story is brought to us by two letters, S and P, and by one number, $1.37 billion. That's what Standard & Poor's, the credit ratings agency, has agreed to pay in fines and penalties to settle state and federal charges that it helped the big banks drag us all down into the morass of toxic assets and mortgage-backed securities gone bad back in 2008, that they had, in other words, given stellar ratings to a whole lot of junk investments. S&P, it should be said, admits no wrongdoing as part of this deal, but we have all collectively reached, perhaps, the beginning of the end of all the investigations into the mortgage meltdown with this settlement. And so we are left, one could say, with a question. Here's Marketplace's Sabri Benishwar.
So what's changed in the world of credit ratings? Well, not much, if you ask Daniel Drossman, an attorney who is suing Standard & Poor's.
The fundamental conflict of interest that has led to this litigation and these massive settlements still exists because you have the rating agencies being paid by the very institutions whose bonds they're grading.
Standard & Poor's doesn't agree, obviously. Adam Schumann is chief legal officer of S&P Rating Services.
The whole industry, and certainly at Standard & Poor's, you know, has really been transformed over recent years.
Schumann says a governance board monitors conflicts of interest, and half the members are independent. He says S&P has beefed up its compliance department, and employees are evaluated on how well they follow the rules. And he says regulation has expanded.
Dodd-Frank created an office in the SEC dedicated to credit rating agencies. And that group conducts annual examinations of each credit rating agency.
Others say the problem goes beyond the relationship between ratings agencies and the clients they rate. Bill Harrington is an independent researcher who worked at Moody's for many years. He says when it comes to the kinds of complex investments at the heart of the financial crisis, there are a lot of vested interests who want to make a credit rating look better than it should.
It's the rating agencies and the bank underwriters and the counsel that is supposedly looking at the deal's merits and the auditors. None of them get paid unless the deal closes with a AAA rating.
This isn't the end of the fight between ratings agencies and authorities. There's an outstanding lawsuit against a Standard & Poor's employee, and Moody's recently became the target of a probe by the Department of Justice. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishwar for Marketplace.
We have been explaining net neutrality on this program for what feels like forever, the idea that all the data that flows across the internet should be equal. No fast lanes, no slow lanes, just a lane. Later this week, the Federal Communications Commission could take us one step closer to never having to explain that again. The FCC is expected to propose new rules changing how the companies that provide internet service are regulated. Best guesses are that ISPs, as they're called, will eventually come to be treated as utilities, more like phone companies than they are now, for instance. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains what that might look like for you and me.
Internet service providers really don't like the idea of being regulated like a phone company. They say that would pave the way for more taxes on consumers, like we see on our phone bills. But Congress has prohibited state and local governments from collecting new internet taxes. What about federal taxes?
We don't know which way the FCC is going to go on any particular provision.
Jody Griffin is an attorney at the consumer group Public Knowledge. She says the FCC could put a universal service fee on your internet bill. It's already on your phone bill. It pays to extend out phone service. But Griffin says the total fees collected might not change.
So there will be some people who are not paying now who would be paying something, and there will be other people who are paying now who will be paying less.
Other consumer advocates say the FCC could now delve into the issue of internet privacy.
We'll have a lot more privacy tomorrow than we do today.
That's Jamie Court, the president of Consumer Watchdog. He says the FCC could use its new authority to prevent tracking on the internet. But the key word here is could.
Everybody can keep powder dry. I don't think there are any immediate changes.
Jonathan Zittrain teaches law and computer science at Harvard. He says FCC officials seem to be just focusing on net neutrality.
These are not wild-eyed radicals somehow wanting to blow up the system.
Zittrain says, remember, This is all stuff the FCC could do if it wanted to. And that's a big if. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
If you're still confused about net neutrality, Marketplace's own Patty Hirsch explains it clear as day in his whiteboard video. It's online at marketplace.org. Check it out. Equity traders followed oil prices today. That is up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Late yesterday, the New York Stock Exchange said it was going to delist Radio Shack. The proximate cause was a share price that hit 24 cents at the close Monday. That is 24 cents a piece, as in per share, which took Radio Shack down below the market capitalization requirements that the NYSE has for companies to be listed there. But the truth is, the company has been troubled for a good long while and, in fact, may not be long for this world. Bloomberg News is reporting that Radio Shack is going to shut itself down and sell about half of its stores off to Sprint. Josh Brustein has the cover story in Bloomberg Business this week. It is called Inside Radio Shack's Slow Motion Collapse. Josh, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
It's a great subhead on this piece. How did the electronics retailer go broke? Gradually and then all at once. It does kind of seem like it's been a slow motion train wreck for this company.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the most common sentiments I heard when I first started making phone calls for this story was, I can't believe it's taken this long for this to happen to Radio Shack.
Why, though? I mean, it's not like we haven't known they were in trouble for years and years and years.
Yeah, Radio Shack has really been struggling to find itself and in some sort of danger since probably the early 90s. The answer for why this didn't happen sooner is starting in the late 90s, the chain really made a push to be right in the middle of the cell phone business. Mm-hmm. It did it at a good time, and that really sustained it for a while. So it actually papered over some of the stuff that was going on. It also, at the same time, allowed the chain to ignore other problems it was having. And once the cell phone stuff started to go bad, it hadn't maintained the rest of the business, right. And that's when we started seeing everything at once.
A nod back to its heyday here. I mean, between the TRS-80, which was whiz-bang for its time, between all the transistors and resistors and cabling that it sold back in, you know, the 60s and 70s when it was huge, I mean, this store was it for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. People see Radio Shack now, it's kind of a joke, I think. Yeah. Like, people definitely talk about it as though, oh, it's this pathetic store, how is it still around? And you really forget that there was a high period for this company. It was right in the middle of the electronics industry at a time that people were kind of figuring out electronics for the first time, and it was there to hold your hand through it. You mentioned the TRS-80. That's one of the first mass market personal computers. Radio Shack actually manufactured it and sold it. It outsold the early Apple computers. So it really does have a bit of a pedigree. And, you know, there's happier times earlier parts of this story.
About the rumors that are floating around out there now that Sprint's going to buy half the stores and rebrand them as Sprint stores. Amazon has said to be interested. Should we assume that Radio Shack as a brand is done and it's just going to be subsumed into something else?
It's not completely clear that that's the case. I think it will be more clear very soon. For the last couple of months, Radio Shack's really been kind of circling the drain. It's been clear that the most likely outcome was bankruptcy. That doesn't mean that it would disappear altogether. But basically, what has to be sorted out in bankruptcy is what happens with all these stores. They have about 4,000 stores. It's way too many for Radio Shack to maintain, which is sort of why it has had so much trouble. But a lot of these stores are, they're valuable real estate, they're in long-term leases, and someone who does want to have a retail presence in electronics, like a Sprint or an Amazon, could find them attractive.
Josh Brustein writes for Bloomberg Business. His story, which is in the magazine this week, is called Inside Radio Shack's Slow Motion Collapse. Josh, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
The profit report from UPS this morning was not so great. Shipping volume was way up, but earnings were down, in part because the company made big investments to meet a holiday rush this past year that never quite did materialize. CEO David Abney said he's going to tack on some extra fees to make sure that, in his words, the company is properly compensated for the value it provides. Those fees include, by the way, with oil off more than 50% since June, an increase in fuel surcharges. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
UPS has quietly changed how it calculates fuel surcharges. The result, even though the price of fuel is down, and even though part of the cost of sending a package is a special charge pegged to fuel prices, the savings on fuel won't be reflected in what you pay for ground shipping. A couple weeks ago, FedEx announced that its fuel surcharge would actually rise from 5.5% to 6%.
How can it go from 5.5% to 6%? Hello?
That's Jerry Hempstead. He's a consultant who works with shipping customers to help them get better rates.
Whoa. Time out. Fuel went down.
He thinks it's the opposite of a price war. First, UPS had higher rates. FedEx bumped. Now it's UPS's turn.
They did it because they could.
The price of sending a package actually includes a whole bundle of little charges, starting with a base rate, which just saw annual increases from both carriers by about 5%. Now we've also got bumps in what are called accessorial charges, like extra fees for delivering to remote locations. And a new way of charging for smaller packages. Instead of charging by weight, shippers now also count the size. Rob Martinez runs Shipware, another consultancy that works with shipping customers. He says that one change raised costs by an average of 17%. For a company that makes microwaves and refrigerators, there might be no impact.
Other shippers, it is literally doubling some of their costs.
If their product doesn't weigh much but comes in a bigger box, for example. Martinez says all this may work for FedEx and UPS because they're the only two national companies in the business.
It's great for UPS and FedEx investors, but lack of competition is bad for shippers.
He says some of his customers are giving the U.S. Postal Service another look. I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we are the first company to automate another machine using a drone.
What could possibly go wrong? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials bumped up another 1.75% today. 305 points ended things at 17,666. Whoops. The NASDAQ cranked up more than a percent, 51 points, closed at 4727. The S&P 500 soared 1.4% higher, 29 points, finished at 2050. We mentioned earlier that ratings agency Standard & Poor's had reached a deal, $1.5 plus or minus billion dollars, with the Department of Justice. That news sent owner McGraw-Hill shares up 4%. Moody's climbed 3.75% today. Twitter fluttered more than 6% higher on news. Its promoted tweets will appear on third-party mobile apps and websites under a new advertising distribution program. Oh, great. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.79%. You're listening to Marketplace.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Senate Special Committee on Aging holds a hearing on combating financial exploitation of vulnerable seniors. It's National Homemade Soup Day. Certainly tis the season for it. And his gruesome credits include Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, and Day of the Dead, among others. Writer-director George Romero turned 75. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The FAA is still trying to make up its mind exactly what it thinks about drones, about how it's going to let people and, more to our purposes, businesses use them. Those businesses, though, aren't waiting around for the bureaucracy to catch up. They are figuring out ways to make drones an ever bigger part of our lives and our economy. That includes a company called Skycatch. Christian Sands is the CEO. Christian, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Let's get the terminology out of the way first. What do you prefer, drone, quadcopter, UAV? What do you like? Because people are sensitive about this.
For us, it's just an aerial robot.
Well, which is somehow almost worse. I don't know. You should probably go with drone.
We use drone a lot. I think that when we talk to the media and talk to the general public, we use drone. And for us, when we talk to investors and our own people, our own staff, we talk about it as aerial robots.
Is it fair to say, then, that you consider yourself a software company instead of a hardware company? I mean, you're interested in the stuff that's running on the drones, right, not the actual things flying around.
Absolutely, yeah. For us, it's just another server that happens to have propellers on it. And I think this is going to happen with the industry as a whole. People are going to talk less about drones and going to talk more about their productivity tools, all the things you can do after the fact. And I think we're going through that phase today with some of these companies.
Well, explain that a little bit, right? Because we're all, most, you know, regular folk out there who aren't in the industry, all we think of are these quadcopters or octocopters or whatever it is, zipping around all over the place. But that word you just used, data, explain that and how you provide it.
So what we do is retrieve a lot of data in the form of images, and then we convert that into aerial maps. So when we talk about our company is all about the data, less about the drone, we talk about not only the mapping and sort of imagery and visibility you get on an ongoing basis using these tools, but also the amount of productivity you can increase by just using these tools on top of the current processes. And again, I can give you an example.
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
In construction, there's a process when you actually build something very complex. There's a lot of layers, and there's a lot of architectural plans that need to be followed in order to build something really efficiently. And that means every single day when you have contractors out there building things, they need to follow an architectural plan. The architectural plan today, when we use our tools, they get matched up with data being captured by the drone, and it automatically checks to see if things are being built the right way very quickly without having to send people out in the field and in harm's way, basically.
So you go out and you map these construction sites or whatever it is, and then it's conceivable, I suppose, isn't it, that autonomous drones could work with autonomous construction equipment, yeah?
That's correct. A big heavy machinery company came to us for help automating their machines. We didn't quite understand what they wanted initially, but until we actually flew out to Tokyo and spent a couple of months, we realized what they wanted to do was to automate their entire fleet of bulldozers and excavators. With the drone, it takes less than 10 minutes to get a 3D model and start doing the actual work using a bulldozer. So we are the first company to automate another machine using a drone.
I want to ask about one of the things you do, which has been called, and I'm not sure if it's you who said this or just the media at large, but Uber for drones. You basically rent them out with pilots who fly these things?
That's correct. So we've invented this concept of being able to, at any given point, open up your app and make a call or just highlight the area you want mapped, and we immediately match you up with a pilot. And the pilot will go out there, create a map, and you'll get a map in the next 2-3 hours. Right now we're going through a process of verifying and also certifying pilots. We have thousands of pilots already subscribed, and we have about 100 plus that have passed our certification process. So if you're a student or if you have a full-time job and you want some extra cash, you can very easily buy a drone, turn it into a work mode drone, and then all of a sudden you can make up to $5,000 a month extra without a lot of effort.
I'm totally in the wrong business then. I mean, if that's the fact, man.
We're going to teach you how to fly a drone.
That's right. Kristian Sons is the CEO of Skycatch. Kristian, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
This month, our sustainability desk is going to be bringing us stories about water, about that thing that is so essential to life, but that typically we take for granted, like it's a cheap, infinite resource that is always going to be there, until it's not. We're going to start in a part of the country surrounded by water, a place where there are streams and rivers, lakes, including one of the biggest lakes on the planet. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner went back to her hometown of Waukesha, Wisconsin, population 71,000. It's a city that has gone, as one writer put it, from water destination to water beggar. Here's Sarah.
When my family moved from Chicago to Waukesha in 1969, I'll be honest, Dad was the only one who wanted to move here. After all, who'd heard of Waukesha? All I knew was that it was somewhere west of Milwaukee. Everybody complained about the one-way streets, and there was a gigantic fiberglass cow in front of the milk bottling plant. But then something happened. Just like every other school kid here, I learned Waukesha had a past, an interesting past.
Waukesha was known as the Saratoga of the West.
John Shane Connect is one of Waukesha's unofficial historians. In the late 1800s, he says, Waukesha was famous for its water. People flocked here during the summers, 25 trainloads a day, to drink cold, pure water from dozens of mineral springs around town. They thought the water could cure everything from diabetes to depression.
Okay, we're going to enter that spring house.
This small octagonal building houses one of the few remaining springs in my hometown.
Whoa, what's that?
That's water.
Is that spring water?
Yeah,
Looking over a railing down into a spring basin lined with marble, you can imagine a time when good drinking water wasn't taken for granted. Shane Connect says they even had dipper boys here to serve it to you.
They would have the rack of glasses that they would dip down into the water, and then you would give them your penny standing up here along the railing, and they would hand you the glass of water.
So a penny a glass.
Penny a glass is pretty much what we figured they did.
And when a savvy entrepreneur tried to pipe Waukesha's water down to Chicago for its World's Fair in 1893, townspeople defended it with their pistols and rifles. Eventually, the springs and fancy summer resorts here fell out of fashion. Most of the springs got paved over or dried up as the city developed. But Waukesha's reputation for good water survived, even when grittier industries moved into town.
Waukesha was really pretty much of a foundry town.
That's Bob Winchell, a family friend who grew up here during the 30s and 40s.
There was Waukesha Foundry, Spring City Foundry, General Malleable, General Casting, it was called.
All the factories needed water, of course. To meet the demand, Waukesha drilled new wells. And that demand really took off when Bob and other young men came home from World War II.
Bunch of young men, everybody wanted to get on with their life, getting married, having family, building houses, and businesses were expanding.
By 69, when my family moved here, Waukesha was a suburb with almost 40,000 people. The houses in my neighborhood had that Brady Bunch feel, and the dairy farmers just a few miles away from us were selling out right and left to developers wanting to build more houses just like them.
They were just coming into City Hall like crazy wanting to annex.
Paul Vrakas was mayor when I lived in Waukesha. I reached him by phone in Florida, where he wisely escapes the Wisconsin winters. He led the city during much of its big growth spurt in the 70s and 80s.
It was like having a tiger by the tail, and I think we did a great job.
Vrakas says if the city hadn't annexed all those new subdivisions that wanted city water, developers would have built them anyway, but on oversized lots with private wells and septic systems that eventually would fail.
We, of course, had the treatment plant, state-of-the-art treatment plant, and municipal water. So it made sense for the city to accept the growth and do it properly.
Nobody back then worried about the water supply. Waukesha paid some of the lowest water rates in the state. In fact, the more a customer used, the lower the rate. Peter Annan, author of The Great Lakes Water Wars, says the city's policies actually encouraged lawn watering.
Because you got a credit on your water bill if you had water that was used but didn't end up back in the sewer system.
No wonder Dad let me play in the lawn sprinkler for hours. But in 1987, the water I'd treated as a plaything officially became a problem. The state put Waukesha on notice. Its drinking water was contaminated. Radium levels were over twice the legal limit. Decades of overpumping had lowered groundwater levels hundreds of feet. And the lower you go, the more radium and other contaminants, says Dan Dukniak. He heads the Waukesha Water Utility today.
We've drawn down the aquifer to the point where we're pulling up the water that's contaminated.
Radium is a naturally occurring metal that's common in sandstone aquifers. Problem is, with a lifetime of exposure, your cancer risk goes up. The state ordered Waukesha to fix its radium problem, but it didn't. Instead, the city resisted. It fought regulators and ultimately sued the EPA. Fixing the problem was going to be expensive, and many in town, including Vrakas, thought the government was overreaching.
And in fact, the Argonne Laboratory said that that amount of radium was no hazard. And many local doctors told me the same thing as well.
Nearly two decades later, Waukesha lost in federal appeals court and decided to stand down. But by that time, the city's population had grown another 20%, and its water quality had grown worse. Author Peter Annan.
Waukesha is this poster child of what can happen when you assume that water will just always be there. And what surprises a lot of people is that here we are in one of the richest water areas of the globe, and yet we are still fighting over water here in the Great Lakes region.
Fighting because cities like Waukesha know they need a secure water supply to keep and attract economic investment. Right now, Waukesha's pinning its hopes on an expensive proposal to pipe in water from Lake Michigan. That's something those pistol-packing Waukeshans who didn't want their water piped out to Chicago probably never could have imagined. In Waukesha, Wisconsin, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Our series is called Water, the High Price of Cheap. Sarah picks up the story tomorrow. We'll find out why Waukesha's plan is attracting national attention and controversy. We've got pictures of Waukesha and its water history and Sarah Gardner herself from back in the 1970s. It's on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, in which the first Friday of the month becomes all that much more exciting if you are a business reporter. Tucked into the president's budget yesterday was a little extra something for the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the good people who put out the monthly unemployment report. Specifically, a couple of million dollars to let them fold what is called the quits rate, people leaving their jobs in search of greener pastures, into the monthly data. It'll let us talk about even more job stuff every month. I know you love that. Also, though, Janet Yellen looks at it pretty closely, too. So, you know, there's that. All right, that's it. We got to go. The Dow up another 1.75%. Today, the NASDAQ up more than 1%. The S&P 500, 1.4% higher. Kate Lanesh and Millie Jefferson are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Our digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.